Again, the number is 438-858-6116. Feel free to call us from inside with news, song requests, and shoutouts. Pass the number along to family and friends on the outside, who are also welcome to call.
The ROXANNE, and you are listening to CKUT.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
What's up, what's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. I'm your host for the evening, Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
J'ai révisé les pages de mon histoire. Épousseter les recoins de mon placard. Mes moments de lumière, de rouge et de noir. Oh, 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 oh. Enfin, ce chapitre tire à sa fin. Je peux fermer les yeux, la plume à la main. En l'honneur de qui je serai demain. Partir à zéro pour prouver qu'on existe. Temps qui passe, temps qui file et nous oublie. Qu'on soit vilain ou héros à travers la tempête. Regretter le passé, ça ne vaut pas la peine. I'm feeling like a criminal. I'm just a chick trying to find my way. I know that time's so critical. I'm gonna save the world another day.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and my guest this evening is no stranger to Soul P, though it's been a couple of years since we've seen her. Her name is Shanice Nicole. She is a black educator, facilitator, writer, and outspoken word artist based in Montreal, Jajage. Her debut children's book, Dear Black Girls, was illustrated by Kesna Dalles and published by Metonymy Press in 2021. She's also the
the curator of free community resources such as Jobs and Things, All Black Everything Montreal, and the BFCN Scholarship Directory. See what she has to occasionally say on social media at Shanice Nicole Speaks. Shanice, welcome, welcome back to Soul P. It's been a few years. How are you doing?
Thank you, Kim. So always, always a pleasure to be here. I'm doing pretty well, as well as can be. It's wild even just saying it's been a few years. I'm so much has happened in a few years, personally and then broadly, globally speaking as well. So it's pretty wild to be coming back to each other in this way.
Yeah. So let's do that because we haven't spoken in a minute. So how has life been for you in the last couple of years? Because obviously there was this little thing that happened at 2020 that kind of sort of affected the entire planet. Because I don't know if you're still doing that, but you were working at McGill.
Yes.
And are you still there? Still there. And you were also doing all of the other wonderful things that you do. Mm-hmm. So how did life change for you? How did that affect you, the pandemic?
Yeah, totally. Might I add how it is continuing to affect, because it is continuing.
Right.
Just gotta put that in there, because I think there's this really interesting dynamic of I think often about the collective, and what does it mean that in so many ways we've kind of collectively moved on or been encouraged to move on, and meanwhile people are still being infected, people are still dying, people are still struggling, so yeah, I'm continuously always in this kind of state of reflection, not just for myself personally, but of course for us as a community or more broadly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so much happened and is happening, so really just again that emphasis on the present and what is continuing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just so many, my life was changed in so many ways, mm-hmm. It's pretty bananas to kind of think about the shift. Of course, COVID affecting so much of my, day to day life.
Yeah.
But probably, kind of at the same time, another big shift for me. I had a baby in the spring of 2021, so I was pregnant in 2020.
Yeah.
So just personally, just so much kind of shift.
Yeah.
But also in a really interesting way, and it's always kind of tricky to kind of talk about either blessings or the positive outcomes of a global pandemic that has killed so many people.
Yeah.
But for me, being able to experience a shift in terms of working from home, and also just the total change in my life in terms of time and, going from out working kind of my 9-to-5 and then all of my things afterwards, and just the regular occurrence of getting home really late.
Yeah.
Just being out and about and seeing people and doing all of the things. And then it went just such a shift.
Yeah.
In terms of the busyness in that way. And so for me, of course the pandemic, but then also being pregnant and having a baby really forced me to just totally shift my life, what was my norm, my kind of standards of practice or interaction. And mm-hmm. It was really an invitation to kind of slow down in a way that I didn't know that I needed.
Right.
And I think a lot of people experience that kind of slowing down, both by force and by choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been also this interesting kind of experience now, kind of, resurfacing and reintegrating, you know, back into the world or back into like my world, and figuring out like, like what fits now, what's possible now, like my capacity has changed. I was even reflecting on this the other day. Like I just used to have like, of course, so much more time. And I don't anymore. So it's forced me just to really kind of like reflect on what's priority and what's most important. And, and within that also, like the things that are priority, like how do we still kind of like make time for them? Given all of the different barriers, you know, like even things like seeing friends.
Yes.
And just, I mean, it's like the whole adult experience of like, you know, trying to make plans with friends, being kind of, I think, a shared kind of challenge. But yeah, just like having to be like intentional about like time has been like a really, I think, major kind of reflection for me.
And yet somehow you managed to publish a book in 2021.
I did, in between all of that.
So tell us a bit about the journey in writing Dear Black Girls, because obviously it started before the pandemic. This wasn't right. So tell us a bit about like what made you decide to write this book.
It's such a a story, you know, in itself. And I was doing a reading not too long ago in elementary school, and like one of the students was like, you know, how long did it take you? And I was like, okay, I'm going to give you my answer, but it's not necessarily a standard answer because it's like years and years and years, like in the making.
Right.
Or I like to say in the talking. I do a lot of talking before kind of, you know, getting into action. But yeah, it's pretty wild to think about like that poem itself. Like I first wrote it during the summer of 2015. So that, you know, I think about that student being like, wait a second, like that's years ago. You're
that
telling
student
me
it's was take, like I was a baby.
Like you're telling me it's gonna take 7 years to so the trajectory of the book, of course, shifted in many ways for lots of different reasons, but the poem itself was in 2015. And one thing that I always kind of talk about is that poem really came from a place, an internal place for me, really feeling like I was not feeling or being seen, and thinking more widely about Black girls in general. And during that time, and of course, like, you know, the years before, for me personally anyways, like my own reflection about race, about state-sanctioned or like government-sanctioned violence, about harm, about representation, like I was really kind of like in this space of reflection. Especially for me, like the murder of Trayvon Martin being like a really
a catalytic moment.
A catalytic moment for me, and really a and for me, that moment offers me a lot of actually like compassion and empathy for the way that people like learn, you know, because what happened to Trayvon Martin was not new. But for me, it felt new. Like it was like a insight into a world that like existed that I just like was not aware of, you know?
Absolutely.
And so it really did like rock me to my core. And during that time, I was really needing an outlet. I was like navigating all of these emotions, of course, that come with like your entire worldview being shifted. And I turned to poetry. And so that was like a way for me to express what I was feeling, which was like so much rage and hurt. And it's interesting as well, even like reading some of my old poetry, and it's like, wow, like the rage is like visceral. And to read it now is so interesting as well, to be like, wow, you were really, really hurting. And understandably so, but like I can also see kind of my own shift and growth, and perhaps also my own numbing.
Yep.
to the reality, you know, kind of years later, which is a whole other, you know, thing to kind of unpack. Yeah. But yeah, poetry for me was like that entry point in terms of expression.
Then when did you decide, or when was that moment when you said, ah, this would make a good book? How did that moment come about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm trying to think about, yeah, I wish I could remember, like, you know, when it exactly originated, but like the origin story that I do remember is sharing that on stage. And so it was during a performance at a show that was organized and curated by Kamala Mackerel. Mm-hmm. And so it was like the Self-Love Cabaret. And so I remember sharing it on that stage, and Metonymy Press was tabling at that event.
Okay.
And there was a friend in the audience who is close friends and connected with Metonymy. And so, yeah, it was like one of those magical moments of me being like, I really would love to turn this into a children's book. And then there being a publisher in the room and a friend who was connected to these publishers. Mm-hmm. And literally that friend, Devin, being like, hey, like, you know, you should publish her book. And I just have had and still am like learning so much about like the publishing kind of process, but, you know, no real kind of idea how it works. But a little bit later, receiving an email in my inbox from Metonymy being like, hey, we're interested in publishing your book. And I was just like, I don't know a lot, but I know this is not, you know, typically how it happens, or how I imagine kind of it happening.
Yeah.
You know, in my mind, I had like this process of like, you know, you have this book or this idea and you have to go and search and seek out and find someone who's like willing to do the thing. And then, you know.
Yeah.
Here I had someone coming to me and expressing interest, so that was just like incredible on its own, and also for me another testament to like the power and importance of community, and, you know, like pushing back against like this myth of individualism. Mm-hmm. And how we like make it on our own and succeed on our own or whatever, and it's like absolutely not like. And I'm not negating my, you know, skill or capacity or talent or whatever. It's really just like, I want to make it so incredibly clear that it's like because of my community and like people who see me and who are like rooting for me, you know, which is like, gosh, just amazing. It's amazing. And now this book is like in the world, and gets to, like, gets to live on in the world. Like, it's incredible.
Mm. And now it's been 2 years since it's been published.
Yes.
So it's had time to be disseminated, and, mm-hmm. and it sounds like you've been doing a few readings at schools and stuff like that. What has the feedback been since the book came out?
Such, like, incredible feedback, and yeah, you know, I like wrote that poem and then, you know, by extension wrote the book because I wanted to see myself. And the result of that is that like so many people have like felt seen. So it's also, again, the testament of like speaking our truth and sharing our story and seeing ourselves in each other as being so, so important and like fundamental to like, you know, my own belief system. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just hearing and receiving the response from people, like also across ages as well. Because one of the things, like the poem itself, like I had only ever performed it in front of adults.
Yeah.
Understandably so, like thinking about like venues for performing poetry.
Yeah.
And so we had all of these like plans to do like focus groups and like testing with young ones and with kids. But obviously then COVID happened, so it kind of just like shifted all of our plans. And so mm-hmm. there was also this element of like putting the book out into the world and not really, you know, having a clear sense of how it was going to be received.
Yeah.
in the form of a children's book, because I did not write the poem with the intention of it being a children's book. So that was an interesting element around, like, okay, how is it going to be received? Which I think is also why the illustrations are so important. And right. by, I mean, of course, for any kind of children's book, but this one in particular, I think really has resulted in the book and the story kind of landing with people in such a like clear and powerful way. Mm-hmm. And we were very intentional about that process as well. And both for Kesna and I, who's just like incredible. And we really wanted that experience of like, we wanted people to open up the book or look at the cover and see themselves or see someone that they knew, someone that they loved, and to just be able to be like, yeah, like, that look like that looks like me, you know, right. like that looks like my mom, that looks like my cousin. And that was just so, so important. Not just because representation is important, but that idea of like, these are stories and narratives that should just be like, it should just be the norm, you know? Yeah.
We should be hearing these stories on a regular basis. They should be a part of the narrative because, you know, there Black people exist, Black women exist, Black girls exist. Exactly. And because of we exist, that means we should be represented across the board. And sadly, that hasn't been the case for far too long. And I love just the explosion of Black beauty that's been happening. Back in March, I went to the Gala Dynasty and I was just swooning at just seeing all of the beautiful Black people, men, women, and everybody in between looking good, walking in there, like dressed up. And I was just like, wow, I have been missing this, you know? And it's a part, like, we are beautiful human beings, yet we have a history of being told that we're not. Mm. You know? And so this book is just a complement to that explosion that's occurring right now. Is it like a matter of it's time? I feel like we've always been beautiful, but it's like, having grown up in the Caribbean, it was a no-brainer. It was a non sequitur for me. It was like, yeah, of course, we're beautiful. But then the last 23 years here in Canada and being in North American, having that North American Canadian perspective has been eye-opening for me, because it's like, okay, no, we have to put an emphasis on this because it hasn't been for way too long.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's such an important, again, reminder about like the locational context having an impact, you know, on either our like experiences of race or racialization or like how we talk about these themes. And it's making me think, I have a friend who bought several copies to bring to Grenada. She was traveling earlier in the summer. And so even as you're saying this, it's making me reflect about like, yeah, I wonder what that experience is going to be for like a Black child in Grenada to like see this book and to read this book. And I imagine, and I'm assuming that there's a different experience than say a Black child here in Canada.
Yeah.
However, like, as we know, colonialism, white supremacy, anti-Blackness are global, don't really care about borders, infiltrate kind of, you know, every and anywhere. And so of course, like there's still going to be those themes, but like that locational and geographic context, I think, is so important in terms of like how we even frame the conversation. And that's important because for me, I want this book, and part of, for me, like the legacy of this book is the way that it's going to create space for ongoing dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I want people to like be in dialogue. Like I have this dream of releasing kind of like a reading guide.
Okay.
You know, for the book, because there's just like so many themes in there, and I want selfishly, like I would love for people to be like having, you know, ongoing conversations about the themes in the book with the children and people in their lives.
Yeah.
And it's not at all, you know, my thinking there is very similar to like my thinking around sex ed, you know, where it's not just like one conversation that you have once and then never again. It's like, how do we return to this conversation and unpack the different themes or the questions or the reflections? And so throughout the poem, like, as I said as well, it wasn't written for children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm talking about pretty kind of like explicit things in many ways. Mm-hmm. But I guess a cool thing is that, like, if you just read it, like, you can kind of decide, like, what depth you want to kind of
right.
engage with the content, which yeah. I think is really, really cool in terms of it really being for all ages in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd love the idea of, you know, someone reading it at 6 and having a conversation, and then they come back to it at 11 and then come back to it as a teen. So that's just like, you know, my personal kind of vision for how the book can also kind of like live on. And I want people to come back to it often.
Mm-hmm.
And to like use it as like a, not just a teaching tool, but like a tool for dialogue and conversation and connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're tuning in for the first time, we are speaking to Shanice Nicole, and we are talking about her debut children's book, Dear Black Girls, that was illustrated by Kesna Dalls and published by Metonymy Press in 2021. We do have to take a quick break and pay some bills, play some music. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the community contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our Voices, Our Perspectives, Our Community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
Ma carte d'affaires, file-moi un petit coup de fil qu'on apprenne à se connaître. Yeah, yeah, L'ultime liste de contacts, j'en suis dignitaire. Laisse tomber ton avocat, y'a pas tant à perdre. Je révise tous les contrats, oui, fais-moi confiance. Je te laisse. Tourne tout le temps, bouge et suis le mouvement, vous ne mettez pas sur le rythme. L'ivresse coule et s'empare de moi et remet au combat tous ces démons qui m'habitent. À quoi ça sert de pleurer le passé? Le tempo me libère des pressions démesurées. Je veux vivre. Channel what you've been through. Tell a story that matters to you. Take a peek into your mind. Let your spirit be the guide to find your way back home. You
remember you're born free from the victim mentality. Or so they can call you crazy, they can call you blind, and you could be afraid, yeah, it's alright. But push through, baby, push through, and stay true, baby, stay true.
Yes, yes, yes. We're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we are speaking to first-time children's author of Dear Black Girls, Shanice Nicole, that was illustrated by Kesna Dowles and published by Metonymy Press in 2021. One of the things that is in her bio is that she is an outspoken word artist based in Montreal. Shanice, Well, first of all, thank you for being here and thank you for sharing with us. Storytelling is important to me, and the storytelling of people is the most enjoyable part of my life right now. Mm-hmm. So I've known you for quite a while, over a decade. Not going to age us up too much more than that.
That's wild.
And for a good chunk of that time, you have been doing spoken word. How did you come to spoken word? What made you decide to start writing?
Well, yeah, I guess, gosh, almost a decade ago now, probably earlier. More than a decade ago, I went to this, it was a show, I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was curated by someone named Kim Dominique Ferguson, if you know him. I'm trying to think. It was like near Concordia, maybe like, I don't know, probably a bar that's unfortunately closed now, I'm sure.
Okay, the Mad Poetics open mic night.
Yeah, it must have been like somewhere on Crescent, I think, or Bishop.
It was on
like
Mackay.
Mackay, okay. Yeah, one of those streets near
The one that you go in the basement.
Yes, exactly. I remember just like going to the show and probably also others and seeing you on stage, actually. And it was like, wow. I was like, wow, this is really cool. And I was like, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do this, like hearing you perform with such like, passion and also like this element of rage as well that I think I was really kind of intrigued by.
Mm-hmm.
It was like seeing you on stage and of course like other performance. I remember, just seeing like different, now as I think about it, different people coming to mind, like Aaliyah, Aaliyah Truth, and Des as well. At one point, I remember just being so mesmerized by like her voice. Of course, Lady Catalyst, who was like also one of like my big inspirations for erotica, which is like where I actually started writing.
Yep.
It was just like seeing you and these other artists kind of on stage, just being so, from my perspective, like unapologetic and bold and a little dirty, a little raunchy, you know? And I was like, wow, I like felt inspired, you know, really felt inspired. And so that was kind of like my invitation, let's say.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about timing wise. Yeah, this would make sense as well because I then auditioned to perform at another show you might be familiar with called The Art of Performing Oral Sex.
Right. Yeah.
Way
yeah.
back when.
Yeah.
And so it was like in preparation for that show that I was like kind of writing my first pieces, which is like, I always think about that being pretty wild as well, is that I started writing and performing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of just like dove right in.
You just stepped off the plank and went right into.
I'm just like, let's just do this.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Yeah, exactly. Like, which is really not my you know, mode of kind of practice. I'm very much one who, like, you know, kind of like aims for perfection before I like do the thing.
Right.
But it was really just like a, hey, like, let's just try this. And so, yes, I was preparing for that show. And then in preparation for that show, I performed for the first time again, bringing Kamala Mackerel back into the conversation.
Yeah.
At an edition of Gender Blender. And so I kind of used that that stage as like a stage to kind of like practice on in preparation for like this bigger show, you know?
Right.
So that was like my first kind of official experience of performing. And I obviously cried on stage. Okay. Was just like so overcome with like emotion.
Okay. Okay.
So literally cried in front of everybody. But it was also just so exhilarating. And I was like, you know, you perform and you're just like, wow, like I want to do this again and again and again.
Interesting. Interesting, yeah. Because some people would probably feel those kind of emotions and nervousness and say, you know what, I can't deal with this, and like basically never go back on stage again or take a long time before they go back on stage. But for you, you were just like, this was just more fuel for the fire to me keep moving forward.
Totally, yeah. And also, like, the response from people as well was so affirming and validating.
Okay.
And it's not, like, crying is, like, my thing. So that's not, like, a, you know, it wasn't, like, a unique experience. Like, crying is, like, kind of, like, my default thing.
Right.
So I was like, okay, cool. This tracks. This makes sense. But, yeah, there was just something so... And to this day, like, my favorite... thing is like when I'm on stage and there's like absolute silence in the room and people are just like waiting to hear what you're going to say next. And so that's like my favorite thing, just kind of like feeling like I have the audience in the palm of my hand, you know, as they say.
Yeah.
It's such a very
addictive, powerful moment, because You control the vibrational frequency that they are about to receive, and you can move them to the left, to the right, up or down with your words. I can understand why, you know, very big artists develop extremely huge toxic egos. Because that feeling of like people are hanging on to your word and sitting on the edge of their seat and like goosebumps, and they're just waiting for the next word, and you pause and that silence. That is one thing. I love that you said that, because I love to play the silences.
Yeah.
And for me, the silences are perfect for not only suspense, but also when I forget my lines.
Absolutely.
Because if I'm performing well, yeah. A silence feels very well timed, you know, and you can bring it back and start saying the line over again and whatnot. So yeah, it's interesting that you had that experience with silence and enjoying
totally.
It.
Totally. And it's my, you know, internalized kind of like desire for power and control, like is I guess stroked by that experience, you know, where it's like, wow, I really am in control here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I can totally see how that can, you know, get to people's heads. But yeah, so that was really just the kind of the introduction. And also, again, something that I thought was so incredible was like, and this connects to the outspoken word element, was the content of my poetry. I was really, again, using poetry and spoken word as like a way to say what I like really wanted to say, and felt like perhaps I didn't always have either permission to, or perhaps like the same amount of like kind of space, space to. And so I was able to, yeah, really be yeah, honest about my feelings, and particularly about like my anger and rage, which I think is like, that's the specific emotion that myself, as a Black woman, but I think more broadly as Black people, mm-hmm. it's like one of the emotions, I won't say the only, but one of the emotions that we don't really get access to, is to like name and to honor our rage. And so poetry enabled me to do that. I was able to be mad, and I was so mad. I was so mad. I was so hurt, by like what was happening in the world around me and what was happening to me also like directly and indirectly. And so I was able to like go on stage and say what I felt, needed to be said. Yeah. And people received it, because that's also like the power of like art.
Yeah.
You know, it creates the space for the possibility of connection and, you know, and those moments where people will kind of come up to you after a performance to be like, you know, I was moved by your words. I was touched by your words. Like, I'm inspired by what you're saying. It's making me think, it's making me question. And that, for me, especially as kind of like an educator and facilitator, like, is like the icing on the cake. Or perhaps even like one of my main kind of intentions is like, I want people to be thinking. Mm-hmm. I want people to feel challenged by what I'm saying or what I'm offering. And so it was such a powerful experience of like, you know, being given the space to say the thing and to like not be interrupted,
right,
and to be affirmed, and then to like, you know, leave the stage and then be affirmed and validated by people in the audience who were across races, across genders, across age, etc., who were just like, I hear you and I see you. And it's like, that's, I think, in many ways what I was desiring.
And you talk a lot about being an educator. How mm-hmm. did you come to take in on that position?
Well, I mean, I think, again, like lineage, like I come from a family of educators. And so that's just been, again, kind of part of my life and like my upbringing, and knowledge sharing has always been like so central to that. So mm-hmm. it feels kind of like, you know,
second nature almost.
Yeah. Destiny in that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, engaging in education in lots of different ways, whether it's like, you know, like, I think about a lot of like popular education that I was doing through like social media, less so now, but like, I think back to like, you know, my Facebook being a place where I was really kind of doing a lot of, education, both in terms of like teaching and knowledge sharing, but then also for me, it was like a space where I was like learning and really kind of being immersed in conversations and reflections about things that were like super new to me, mm-hmm. or that I was curious about. So there's like those informal spaces, but then of course, you know, and like, as I like to say, like my day job at McGill. So I do a lot of education there, again, around content on oppression and race and racism. And so it's interesting to kind of be in like these really formal spaces, but then also the informal spaces and how the conversations are similar or different. And also thinking about like, for me, again, as an educator, it's like, how do we invite people into the conversation? How do we invite and open up space for learning and for dialogue, and for knowledge sharing of all different kinds, regardless of like the environment? And so that for me is really kind of exciting to think about the different places in my life where I get to do that. Mm-hmm. And then I also co-teach a course at Ecole Setsuko, which is like a massage and bodywork school. And so that's also really, again, cool, like a little bit of an in-between of like the informal and the formal. But yeah. I feel really lucky to be able to like, be in these different spaces and to engage in like learning processes with students of all kinds, mm-hmm. and with people of all kinds. And then, of course, like those different experiences like help me in terms of yeah, like thinking strategically about like how to convey a message or how to read a room or mm-hmm. how to have an idea. So like, okay, this is my audience. And so this is like the shift I'm going to make so that my message is received and is clear. Cause it's, you know, a cool thing about poetry and art in general is that like you create it and you put it out there and like people will do with it, you know, as they will. But for me, I have like there's an element of like desire for people to really kind of engage in it and to reflect on it and to critique it as well. Like I want us to like be in conversation about it, you know? Yeah. Like I think about even performing Dear Black Girls in places and having like vivid memories of lots of questions I get often is like, either like, you know, why is it necessary? But there's also another question about like, one comes up often is like, are you going to like write one about boys mm-hmm. as well? So there's like, again, it's stirring people to kind of think and to question and to wonder. So
yeah,
for me, that's like a sign of like a, you know, a job well done.
Yeah.
Like as an educator is that people are questioning.
Mm-hmm. And that people are requesting as well, more mm-hmm. content. When you were a part of the inaugural Phenomenal 5 show back in 2016, and I did later iterations of it, and when I was able to do a full 5-day performance, theatrical performance, one of the things was, okay, where are the Phenomenal brothers, you know? Mm. So it's like, I feel like, I agree with you. I feel like that's a testament to a job well done, because people appreciate the representation, and now they want to see more different and just as powerful or just as needed. Mm-hmm. As well. Right. I know it's not in your bio, but I know, and it's actually one of the first, I guess you could say, core memories that I have of you.
Okay.
What I remember, I don't know if it was the first time that we met, but you were a part of, because you were studying at McGill, right?
At Concordia.
Okay, you were studying at Concordia, and you were giving a talk about sex and gender, and I believe consent was a part of the discussion as well. And it was a part of the Caribbean Students Union. Like, we were on the 7th floor. And I was watching you, and I was like, wow, like, people can talk about sex and race and gender. Like, even though I had been producing the erotic poetry show for years at that point, 2 or 3 years at that point, I had never really been engaged in a conversation where I was sitting in the audience and this conversation was about sex with someone who looked like me.
Mm.
And it was extremely fascinating to me because I love talking about sex. I think sex is the most amazing act that we can do. And we don't have enough conversations about it. We don't understand. I believe that too many people lack an understanding of what sex and sexuality is and how to relate to a partner. What was it that drew you? Because I know that this is also, I don't know if you're still doing a lot of that work, but in the early times of you doing educational work, you did put a lot of emphasis on sex education. What was it that you felt that you wanted to go in that direction?
Yeah, it's so funny. And my, you know, my Facebook always pops up with the memories. And so that was like, I think my memory either today or yesterday, sometime this week, was like that talk in Concordia, like on the 7th floor. And like the poster was there, like, let's talk about sex. We like taped condoms to like the poster. And yeah, just so, again, feels like an entire lifetime ago. But I'm so glad that you named that and you reminded me that you were there as well. And that was also really cool as well, just to be having that conversation with primarily Black folks, because it was organized by the Caribbean Student Union at Concordia. So that in itself was like also really just like special to be able to like, you know, be in that space and to again have dialogue and to be talking about things that we like talk about in secret or in private, offline.
Yeah. And maybe without as much information, factual information, like we kind of talk about it, but we talk about it in a very superficial way, and a subjective way as well, as opposed to an objective way and from a space of knowledge and information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've always been like so curious about sex, and about bodies and about sexuality, like all of it, you know? And I was 15 actually, and I had a very clear plan of becoming a sex therapist. And I was like in Ontario at the time, so I was like, how do I do this? And the only program at the time was the degree at UQAM in sexology, mm-hmm. but it was in French. And so I was like, okay, I'm obviously not gonna do that. But Concordia at the time had a minor in sexuality studies, which has now wonderfully become a major. But I was like, okay, cool. I'll do the minor.
Right.
So that was kind of like my, you know, backup. Like it wouldn't lead me to the same place, but I was like, at least I can still kind of, you know, learn, mm-hmm. learn a bit. So that was kind of like always a desire, which really kind of came from this place of curiosity. And then I was curious and I had questions and there weren't really people giving me answers. And so I wanted to seek those out. And also I was like, you know, the person who like my friends would come to with questions or ideas, or I would share kind of questions or reflections. And that's kind of been the case for a while. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really kind of came out of this place of like, I'm curious and I have questions and I feel like I'm not the only one. So I'm so, so passionate about sex ed. Like you're right. That's really kind of where I started in terms of education. Particularly shout out to Head and Hands. So the Sense Project at Head and Hands, which is a peer-based inclusive sex ed project that was created in response to the Quebec government phasing sex ed out of the provincial curriculum.
Right.
In 2005. So there was like a long period of time where there was no government mandated sex ed in schools, which is bad.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the response was like, okay, let's create something where students can at least get the information that they need to make informed decisions about their bodies, about their health, about their relationships. And of course, you know, it's always kind of the focus is on young people. But as I'm aging and growing up, it's like that reminder and realization that like, wait a second, like we as adults still need, sex ed, if yeah. not even more so,
yeah.
In our kind of adulthood, you know, and again, thinking about like the power of misinformation.
Yeah.
The power of myths being kind of, you know, touted as like fact or as science or as whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important that that kind of across the ages, like people have access to adequate and inclusive sex ed that really is reflective of people's like needs and reflective of like the current context. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, across the ages, because you know, one of the things that's happening now and has been happening, even thinking about like the infection rates and spread of STIs within nursing homes.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Right. And so again, so like that, again, so much to unpack there, but our idea about like who is having sex and what type of sex people are having and therefore where education is needed. And so like across the lifespan, people are not getting access to the information they need to make informed decisions, again, about their health, about their bodies, about their relationships. And so it's not just like an issue for kids or an issue for teens or an issue for adults or so I think that's also just really interesting in terms of like what does that mean across the board. So many of us don't have access to the information that we need and deserve.
And a lot of people are getting educated by pornography and are getting educated
in ways that are not necessarily realistic to neither themselves nor the people that, like, outside of the porn industry, because people forget that the porn industry, they are paid professionals, they are actors, and things that they may seem like they're enjoying in those movies, then people might not necessarily be enjoying them in real life, you know.
Right.
And the ways that they go about doing what they're doing, the consent has been given before, they understand everything beforehand, and so therefore it's sensationalized in a way, but you can't do those things in the same way in real life without informed consent and or permission.
Mm-hmm, totally. And then even down to things like, I love reminding like young people of this, I'm like, you have to remember, as you said, like, people are, one, working, they're professionals. But I'm like, there are people doing lighting and sound, and refreshments are being offered. Like, that's not the, you know, the reality for most of us when we're engaging in sex. Like, we don't have someone adjusting our lighting and making sure the sound is good and making sure we have water when we need it.
Yeah. And putting on the makeup.
Totally, totally.
Retouching
to make sure that,
and all
like,
of that stuff.
You know, skin tones of, you know, whatever parts of your body are in alignment in the way that they want. So it's like all of these elements, again, the reminder that it's a production.
Yeah.
And it's a production because it's a form of entertainment, right? So
yeah,
I think that's just, again, so important. But of course, if we don't have space to kind of talk about that, what becomes our models, or our, like, the things that we either compare ourselves to, or use as, like, a reference point or a standard, like, that becomes really, really dangerous in many ways, you know? And I think, again, the challenge of, like, this is a debate that happens often, like, whose responsibility is it to do the teaching? You know, is it, like, the parents' responsibility, or, like, the school's responsibility, or neither, or both, or whatever? Yeah, even in that, it's like a flawed debate, because, like, across the board, no one has enough like knowledge and resources to kind of be like doing the teaching, whether it's like parents who are not informed, or caregivers who are not informed, or schools who are not informed, because, like, the way things kind of typically work is that it's like up to the discretion of the teacher to integrate whatever content that they want, whether or not that content is up to date, whether or not that content is inclusive of, like, a range of experiences, whether or not that content is even, like, accurate, or, like, biased, you know, from their own perspectives, like, whatever their perspective is. So, like, there's so much there where it's, I think it's so important for us to really, really reflect on, like, where in particular, I think about youth, like, where youth are getting access to information.
Mm-hmm.
And for me as well, like, sex ed is such an incredible entry point for, again, dialogue and conversation about so many themes, like, whether it's talking about class or gender or sexuality or race or ability, capitalism, colonialism, like, there's so much that we can talk about from the entry point of sex or sex ed.
Mm-hmm.
But so often it's really presented as just like, okay, we're going to talk about condoms and pregnancy. And that's like it. The extent of our information, you know, as if like those are the only ways that people are engaging in sex or reflections around that. So I've always been so grateful as well for that to have been my own entry point into education, because, again, it really gave me tools to be able to, like, have, you know, tricky and sticky conversations. And even in my work, you know, at McGill, I used to always say, like, listen, if I can talk to teens about, like, clitorises, like, I can talk about race, you know, like that idea of, like, okay, how do we get comfortable in the discomfort?
Yeah.
So I really appreciate kind of like my background and kind of training in that regard, because it's really helped me get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're tuning in for the first time, we are speaking to Shanice Nicole, author, educator, and we're talking about her journey, and beyond. We do have to take a quick break and pay some bills, play some music. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT.
Everything I touch will turn to gold. 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 And it's okay, say what you gotta say, 'cause you don't know, yeah, you don't know. I tell myself too many times, don't lose your mind trying to get by. I can't be doing this time.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and my guest this evening, no stranger to Soul P, is Shanice Nicole, a Black educator, facilitator, writer, and outspoken word artist based in Montreal, Jojage. Her debut children's book, Dear Black Girls, was illustrated by Kesna Dalles and published by Metonymy Press in 2021. She is also the curator of free community resources such as Jobs and Things, All Black Everything Montreal, and the BFCN Scholarship Directory. See what she has to say occasionally on social media at Shanice Nicole Speaks. Shanice Nicole, thank you so much for being here this evening. I love the conversations that we have because we always go all over the world and everywhere with our conversations when we end up talking. I want to talk a bit about your community work that you do, your Jobs and Things, and a bit about All Black Everything Montreal and the BFCN scholarship. What are those things?
Yeah, great question. So Jobs and Things is this like little resource that I started years ago now, probably also, I think like 2016, which would make sense. So it started out as like a Facebook. Remember when Facebook used to have notes?
Yes.
Back in the day. Yes. So it started as a Facebook note, and it was really just me kind of like sharing primarily jobs, job opportunities, hence like the job, but also other things, especially like art related opportunities, writing things. So it just kind of started out as like this little Facebook note. And for me, it was, I'd say 2016, because that is when I got the job at McGill. And I spent, I mean, since I like moved to Montreal, and also of course being like a student for most of that time up until that point, you know, I was like no stranger to like the hustle of job searching and job finding, and especially also being an Anglophone person here with like limited French capacity in terms of like in a working context. So like, you know, always kind of on the hunt for jobs. And then I landed this big dreamy job, you know? And so for me, there was this element of like, gosh, and it was such a kind of struggle. in terms of like leading up to the job that I got at McGill. And so I used to refer to it as like my favorite procrastination activity, which was like working on Jobs and Things. Right. But it was also, I think, out of like that place of like, should I remember, sorry, shoot, I'm not sure if I can swear, of like remembering, gosh, I remember what it was like just like that struggle of job searching. And so much of the process is actually the like, the doing the searching and the finding the things. And so I was like, oh, let me just like kind of put them together. Mm-hmm. And so it started as a
Facebook note.
As a Facebook note. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was like another kind of model in between. I can't remember, but then I kind of recently transitioned over to like this new platform. So it's more of like a newsletter format, which was great because the Facebook note, of course, had like restrictions on how much you could include.
Yeah.
And it very quickly kind of expanded. So anyways, now it's in a Google Doc format, dozens of pages kind of long, and it's released every month or ish. It's also like, of course, like my time has changed. So like I used to just have a lot more time to kind of procrastinate. And now it's like, oh, shit.
Now you're budgeting your time very, very rigidly.
But, yes, but it's still so important to me. And it's like amazing because there's like over, I think, 1,500 people are now subscribed to it.
Wow.
Which is like, just like so cool. In and of itself in terms of thinking of how it started, but just hearing from people who have used it and continue to use it, and that it's like helped people find jobs and opportunities, which is like what I,
that's the objective,
like the objective. And so when I hear that from people, like my heart is just so warmed by that, because again, like I remember that feeling of searching for something, you know, for an opportunity. So that's Jobs and Things. So it's like mostly things based in Montreal, but especially, of course, with COVID and how remote opportunities kind of expanded. So mm-hmm. there are, of course, the remote opportunities included in there. And then if it's like relevant enough, or, you know, from my biased perspective, I think it's like cool enough, like I'll include things from other provinces.
Yeah.
Yeah, so kind of like, you know, up to my discretion in that way of what's included, but it's really just like a cool and I think important resource in terms of like it being a place that people can at least kind of go to and start their process. So that's Jobs and Things. And so again, really encouraging people to use that and to share it. And it's a free resource and will always be free. And I do encourage people, like, if it's, you know, useful to them, or if they have like the financial capacity to, that they can make a donation, and all of the proceeds or all of the money that ever comes in as a donation is redistributed to Black and Indigenous people in the community. So I do some kind of like informal local fundraising efforts.
Yeah.
And so that's been like an incredible way also to kind of connect people and to allow for like support for people to be like, hey, this resource is useful for me. Here's $5. Here's $50. Here's $500. And I'm able to like take those funds and like literally put it into the pockets of Black and Indigenous people, which for me is always so important.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Jobs and Things. And then All Black Everything. Montreal is kind of another resource, again, as you can imagine from the title, which is really, again, about like collating all of the Black people and Black initiatives kind of in the city.
Yeah.
And using it also as a way for people to kind of promote themselves and like their own work and their own services.
Yeah.
And so that's been cool. It's super kind of informal in terms of like how it's like used and how I update it. But for now, like it's, you know, it's within my capacity. So it's just like a spreadsheet that exists and people can make requests to make changes. It also, I think, picked up some interest during the summer of 2020 following the murder of George Floyd and the results of people, I think, being perhaps more intentional about wanting to either like seek out and or support Black folks.
Yep.
And Black businesses, Black initiatives. So that was also kind of like a connecting resource for people to be able to like seek that out. And then the BFCN scholarship directory, that is connected to my family's nonprofit in Ontario. Okay. So the Black Foundation of Community Networks. Mm-hmm. That's led by my mom, who does a lot of organizing in the Toronto community or north of Toronto.
Yeah.
And one of the initiatives that we have is a scholarship program. And so the scholarship directory is connected to that program. And so very similarly to Jobs and Things, one of the big challenges for students and for young people is like the researching of the different awards and scholarships that exist primarily, but not exclusively for Black students. And so it's a resource that's like a compilation of about 50 or so that exist with kind of like clear information about the process. So like there's a checklist for each award or scholarship. So people are able to at least have a little bit of support in their own kind of application process and reducing some of the barriers that exist for students. And I always think about like, yeah, being a young person and it can be so challenging, you know, when you're just like trying to find out information, but like websites haven't been updated or yeah. you're not sure what's happened. And it's like I remember being 15, 16, like you're only going to call so many times or email so many times. And so
yeah.
thinking about how we can support our students or young people kind of in those endeavors of being interested in post-secondary education and wanting to seek out funding opportunities.
Yes.
So that's a link to kind of my Toronto, Ontario life. But the other two resources are mostly like Montreal based.
What I'm hearing from you is a deep commitment and love for your community in these yeah. actions. Where did that come from? How did that become a part of who you are?
Yeah, that's again, thinking about like lineage and family and like my mom in particular, who has always been kind of my model for that, you know, and I love my community so much and so deeply. And as I said, kind of in the beginning, like, you know, everything that I am and everything that I've been able to do has been made possible by my community, by people.
Yeah.
And so I fundamentally believe in the importance of like leveraging your power and leveraging your access to resources to support other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Toni Morrison has a quote, I'm going to like butcher it, but really talking about like, again, the importance of like opening up doors for other people. Like you don't just like get in the door and then go off on your very little way, you know, it's how do we bring our people in and with us? And I'm not just talking about like within the institutional context, I'm really just talking about like, how do we move together?
Yeah.
And again, as I said, pushing back against that myth of individualism and really thinking about like the importance and the power of a collective. And I have access to so many resources, you know, of so many kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a responsibility to share that. And as I said, to like leverage my power so that others can have the same, you know, or can at least have something similar.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that for me is like, I learned that from my mother and just watching her serve really, and watching her also just like express love for her community, since I was like a young girl, you know? And so it's been really incredible to kind of like work together in many ways. We do a lot of the work with BFCN together. Her and I co-facilitate the scholarship application workshop. And mm-hmm. so we are, you know, facilitating with Black students and their families and connecting with school boards. And so it's like really wonderful to have that shared experience with my mom and to kind of like watch and to learn from her, but also for her to like watch and learn from me. Again, like that that ongoing kind of dialogue and learning process is so important kind of in all my relationships.
Yeah.
But yeah, very much kind of from my mom, but then also I think about my grandmothers as well, who also taught me a lot about like serving and also serving like their people and their community. And, you know, whether it's my maternal grandmother, like I think about, especially kind of over COVID, it was interrupted, but she grows like tons of vegetables like in her garden in right. England. And she would like, yeah, harvest the veggies and like bring all of these veggies like to church and distribute them and just share them, you know, sharing what she had because she had an abundance. Mm-hmm. So that's what she does, you know, or like currently she knits like hats and blankets for newborns who are in like the NICU.
Right.
So I just like to think about those things, or my paternal grandmother who recently passed. And just also, of course, sometimes like this happens and it's, again, a reminder to like, yeah, you know, if people are alive and in your life, like to like nurture those relationships with yeah. them and to like learn these stories, you know, before they're gone. But learning so much about her and just how instrumental she was like in her church and in her community. And she was a very well-known kind of cook and baker, which I always love because I obviously like tons of different hats, but years and years ago I had a little cupcake business called yep. Sweet Treats by Shanice. So I just like think about like that kind of like connection to my grandmother through, you know, her kind of experience in life as a baker. And she baked all the cakes for all the weddings and all the parties and all of the celebrations and did all of the cooking. And I see that in myself, you know, I love hosting and bringing people together and sharing food. And so, yeah, there's very much like a family kind of history there of like serving and of connecting people and just like expressing love in that way. So I feel grateful to, yeah, my mother and grandmothers who really taught me how to do that.
Mm. My comfort for your loss for your grandmother.
Thank you.
One of the things that the questions that is reverberating in my mind, because at the beginning of the show, you told us that during the pandemic, you became a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how does being a mom, has it been modified or complemented like by your perspective on how to move in this world? How does being a mom affect that the way you move in the world?
Mm. Yeah, such a good question. My goodness. Yeah, in so many ways. Like, I think one of the biggest challenges, and I mean that both in like it's been hard, but also it's been so exhilarating, is like that for me, anyways. Like the experience of parenting and the experience of mothering, forcing me to do so much like self and internal reflection. And in my perspective, like that's really what like the bulk of parenting is. Like it's actually not about like the child, like it's about yourself.
Yeah.
And the child often acts kind of either as the mirror or like holds up the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question of like, do you want to look and see what's there, you know? And so there's like this element of invitation. And so I've really been experiencing parenthood and motherhood as an invitation to like look at myself and to look within, and to be honest and to be curious. Because I am like helping to raise like this little person,
mm-hmm.
you know, who's like discovering the world and discovering like who they are in the world, who they want to be. And gosh, like what a blessing to kind of have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I've really just, as I said, like in this kind of constant state of reflection and of learning and again, being curious, because parenting is teaching me so much about how to do that. And it's so hard because it's so revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't always like what you see in the mirror and like what's revealed to you. And, but it's necessary. It's necessary, you know, because I really want to be, again, back to like having such incredible access to resources.
Yeah.
Like for me, there's a real, real sense of responsibility, to be intentional about the way that I parent, about what I'm modeling to my child, about how I'm showing up in the world, about how my words are in alignment with my actions. Yeah, and so parenting is teaching me about how to be honest in a way that I didn't even know was, like, possible, you know? Like, I've always been a pretty, like, you know, reflective person and curious person, but it's, like, to such a different degree now, and I mentioned earlier, kind of like sitting with my desires for control. And in parenting, like your desire for control comes through all of the time, all of the time, because you are parenting this little young person who, as I said, is in a place of like constant discovery.
Yeah.
And so it's like, what do I do with that desire for control? And what does that, what does that say? And how does that also challenge like my reflections about like power and oppression and abuse or misuse of power, and how like easy it is and can be to do that, particularly in the context of like a child. But of course, we can think about so many other factors.
Yeah.
And so again, it's forcing me to be like, okay, are my words in alignment with my actions?
Mm.
You know, am I practicing what I preach? And it's, yeah, it's so, so hard, but it's so incredible to be in it, you know, and to be learning and to really approach it with humility. And as I said, curiosity and this desire to, you know, my, like the quote that I live by Maya Angelou, like, well, totally out of my head. Do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better.
Mm, I like
and
that.
For me, it's like, again, this constant kind of invitation to like, what am I learning? How do I apply it? How do I integrate it? How do I share it?
Yeah.
So, you know, whether it's like having conversations with my parents about parenting, and again, like being able to do that from like a different perspective now, where there are things that I never understood before that I now have more of an understanding of, or things that I'm learning that I'm able to like kind of bring to my parents and to offer them different or like new perspectives of things that like just were not within their realm of possibility, you know, when they were children or when they were new parents or older parents or whatever. And to be able to like have those conversations is also so incredible. So I feel just unbelievably grateful for, you know, as they say, like it takes a village, and I have such an incredible village, because parenting and child raising is not meant to be done in isolation.
Mm.
And it is in so many ways. And it that coupled with like a global pandemic has meant like isolation has been kind of a theme. And so because of that, I've been able to really kind of just like turn inwards and really do that self and inner work. But then also, again, speaks to the importance of like not staying in the isolation and really making sure that we're like connecting with others and sharing with others and learning with others and being open to like transformation, because you're witnessing a child transform so rapidly in so many ways. And yeah, as I keep saying, it's an invitation to be curious about that, and to see what are the ways that like I myself as an adult can change and can grow and can develop. So yeah, it has totally shifted my perspective of the world. and has made me really more intentional about how I want to move in it.
Yeah. Shanice, that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you so much for sharing your words of wisdom, sharing your story, your history, her story with us. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, please do go and pick up a copy of Dear Black Girls. I believe it's at Librairie Racine.
Yes.
And it's pretty much accessible in all of the other stores. So Amazon, yes, and Indigo and them. And look out for Shanice Nicole at Shanice Nicole Speaks on social media. You can find her, follow her, and follow her on their journey. Thank you once again, Shanice, for being here this evening.
Thank you, Kim.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are tuning in for the first time, you can listen back to the full show at 8:31 p.m. on our website, www.ckut.ca. Click on Programming and Archives, scroll down over to Tuesday, then down to 7 p.m., and you can listen to the full show. Other than that, join us back here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 8:30 p.m. You're listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
We mobbing to the beat, wanna preach, but the wanna be my enemy. Holding heat, and they could it be the death of me? Why they do what they do? We still fighting to be free. You already know. Gotta cut the check before the show. Never flex before you go. Rather have me acting like a hoe. No smoke, no.
Yeah, I know them no want no smoke. Them taking man for a joke.
A chain, I break a chain, the drama change, poison veins, I cut it down like sugar cane, burning effigies of my enemy, if we in the house, then it's fire to the premises.
No. Gotta cut the check before the show, never flex before you flow, rather have me acting like a hoe, no smoke, no, y'all know that no one no smoke.
Feels like a turn.
Let's get it. I don't bounce, I don't sway, I just skip on them, skip, skip on them. Look what I did on them, do it big on them, steady dip on them. Tell my homie, y'all, we about to do a little jig on them. I don't bounce, I don't sway, I just skip on them, skip, skip on them. Look what I did on them, do it big on them, steady dip on them. Tell my homie, y'all, we about to do a little jig on them. Chest pop. Skip, whoa, smack, groove, whip, pose, wobble, focus, placement. We jabbing the streets, your room, the basement. We labbing, I'm hefty, I'm live, no guessing. Just bring it, grab them, slam them, snatch it, then swing it. Bang out, bang out, bang out, bang out, bang out, bang out, man, we bang it out on them.
This is Jay-Z. When I'm flying through Canada, you know I'm checking out CKUT 90.3, you heard?
Expozine 2023, Canada's biggest and best zine fair, is back. Don't miss your one chance to check out new books and zines created by hundreds of independent voices. Whether it's radical zines, comics, poetry, or the small press in both English and French, you'll find it at Expozine. Check out expozine.ca for information about programming, about the opening party on December 1st, and to see the list of participants. The Expozine Fair takes place on December 2nd and 3rd from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Free admission at 1025 Bélanger, right near Jean Talon Metro. Visit expozine.ca for more information. An ArcMTL and CKUT co-presentation.
Good evening and how are you doing? Welcome to the Sounds of West Indian Rhythms. My name is Howard Carr.
On November 15, we're putting CKUT on the map of Afro-Montreal culture and nightlife, that is. Nightsofmontreal.com. ArcMTL and the Afro Museum present a new monthly series on the history and evolution of the Afro-Montreal culture and nightlife.
On November 15th, 5 p.m., CKUT Radio with Howard Stretch Carr and Butcher T.
For over 35 years, CKUT has been an important voice for Montreal's diverse black community, thanks to numerous radio shows such as Stretch's West Indian Rhythms and Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. Come find out how it all began with Stretch and Butcher T. Free admission at the Afro Museum, 533 Ontario East, corner Barrie, near Barrie Metro Station.
Visit knightsofmontreal.com for more information. A CKUT co-presentation.
Stretch from West Indian Rhythms stole you that.
Ascoltate emissione di radio Marcarlo per 90.3 FM CKUT.